This Civic Media podcast is sponsored by UW Organ and Tissue Donation. Organ donations are desperately needed, and now is the right time to become an organ donor. Talk to your family. Get the dot. Save lives. Go to heroicdeed.com.
Welcome, welcome. Oh my goodness. We have another episode of The Rational Revolution. I am your fearless host here, Mark Becker. Last episode before Thanksgiving. We're going to talk at the end of the show. I have some to-don'ts of Thanksgiving. The coach Mark will come back and we'll talk about some of that stuff. But I want to, this is a really important episode, I think. And I'm going to set it up like this. I was reading an article. It was a Substack article, and we'll post it to our Civic Media page as well. And it was really eye-opening. The year was 1930. United States was beginning the Great Depression. People were angry. People were upset and poor, and they were looking for someone to blame. The second worst president in U.S. history, Herbert Hoover, they gave him someone to blame, and in a tale as old as time, he decided to blame people who didn't look like white people. So he blamed people who are of Mexican descent and enacted a years-long program that was labeled American Jobs for Real Americans. And more than 1.8 million people were sent back to Mexico. I had no idea about this. It was staggering. And it was a heartbreaking statistic that I learned from this article that nearly half of those people who were deported were actually U.S. citizens. And so now here we are almost 100 years later, and we're talking about this again. I really want to encourage people to read that article because it really is an eye-opening and kind of mind-boggling thing. And here to talk about that is the guy who wrote it. He's an expert in the subject of Latino history, amongst many, many other things. He's a political strategist, co-founder of the Lincoln Project. He's a successful author whose book, The Latino Century, How America's Largest Minority is Transforming Democracy. It is available everywhere books are sold. He's an all-around good guy, friend of the show. Mr. Mike Madrid joins me here.
Mark, so great to be with you again. Love doing the show.
Thank you so much for coming back. I really appreciate it. And how the heck have you been?
Well, it's been a bumpy run, as it's been for you and for everybody else. You know, this is the first time in 30 years that I haven't been on a big campaign.
Yes.
I was doing the book tour, and I got to tell you, a book tour is just as tough or tougher than a campaign. And maybe that's a function of I'm just getting a little bit older, but I'm glad to get a little bit of rest, and it hasn't been long. We're right back at it, but it's been a bumpy ride.
How many places did you hit? Like, where did you all go?
Oh, good. I mean, I was all over the country. I mean, it was everywhere from the Kennedy Library doing events to
That's
Austin,
awesome.
Texas doing events to California, Arizona, Nevada, just bouncing around everywhere. So I'm not even sure how many we've done, just tons of them.
Well, so your calendar is not your own, as I found out. That's so cool. Kennedy Library, we were just there this summer. Beautiful place. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
They've got that
Senate, they've got a wing of it for the Ted Kennedy Institute, which is literally a perfect replica of the floor of the Senate. And that's actually where we did the event.
Oh, that's so cool. Really? That's neat. So I have you here because I want to talk about what people need to know about the proposal of, this mass deportation and everything. But I'd like to start with this. Since you were here last, a couple things have happened.
Yeah.
So it was specifically in November. What happened?
Well, look, there's a couple of things that I think that offer a lot of keen insight here. And the first is, as we're finalizing a lot of the vote counts, I want people to remember that this was not that, the early reactions are always much more different than when you get the final data in. This was a really, really close election.
Really?
Donald Trump is going to actually end up, winning by less than winning the popular vote, which is peculiar. It is peculiar for a Republican to be able to win the popular vote, but he's going to lose it by a smaller margin than Hillary Clinton won.
Huh.
And the margin in those three states is sitting at less than 100,000. So it looks very much like the Hillary Clinton race versus Donald Trump in 2016, much more obviously than the 2020 race. But this idea that somehow this was, you know, this massive shift, at least from a partisan perspective, doesn't seem to have much weight in fact. Now, having said that, virtually every group in the country did move to the right. But when we're talking about moving to the right, we're talking oftentimes marginally, you know, a couple points here, a couple points there, which leads most of us to believe that this probably had something to do with more about the dynamics of the current economy and political environment than it did some massive political realignment.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I suppose. So, and you know, but if you, the Republicans don't like facts that much these days. And so they'll talk about, you know, we're governing on a mandate and all of that stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's no question about that. That'll be part of the strategy. Like I said, a small margin of victory, a big margin of victory, I mean, the end result is the same. Nobody's contesting that. And perhaps, moreover, you know, more uncomfortably, they're going to hit the gas full steam and kind of head in the direction they want to go.
So what do the Dems have to do? I mean, like, what's the play for them?
And again, even though this loss was relatively small, I think it's important to put in the context of the past decade. Again, and this is kind of why I wrote the book, and we talked about this. The Democratic Party is no longer the party of the working class. And they just are going to either have to come to terms with that and recognize that in order to fix it, or they can continue to sort of deny it and keep having these elections where these types of things happen, a 2016 event or a 2024 event, with, you know, a 2020 kind of saving them in the middle. There is a realignment that is happening that is happening along class lines, but it's happening incrementally, but over a decade, 12 years really, those incremental two-point margins start to get bigger and bigger and bigger when they compound, and now you're starting to see the Democratic Party, I think, starting to reel a little bit and recognize maybe we're not the party that we thought we were.
Can they get that back?
Oh, for sure. 100%. Of course they can. Yeah, there's nothing permanent about this. And like I said, they've got to be serious about it. They've got to be committed to it. They can't ignore it. They can't deny it. But this system, this two-party system, does have a remarkably resilient way of bouncing back and forth. I mean, just weeks before the election, everybody was saying about how much Donald Trump had essentially destroyed it and gutted out the Republican Party.
Yes.
Could it ever come back? So, yeah, look, there's a lot of over-dramatization in politics. That's why we kind of like it. That's why we get a little addicted to it. That's why we stay focused on it. Yeah. And I'm not trying to diminish the reality of the moment, but to suggest anything other than, yes, of course, it's completely fixable. It's completely reconcilable. There was no doubt that this will be, you know, competitive going forward. Every presidential campaign since the year 2000 has been very, very competitive. There's no evidence to suggest that that's changed at all.
You know, and I on the other side, it was the day after the election. I text messaged another friend of the show, Joe Walsh, and I was like, "Okay, well, now what?" And he said his response was, "Well, I guess we're pretty much all Democrats now." You know, so is the GOP gone?
That is interesting that would come from Joe, who's a dear friend and a really bright mind and a great man.
He's a good guy.
I'm not sure. That seems to make sense. The whole idea of the Never Trump movement, the resistance movement, there's no question it essentially died. The truth of the matter is there were never that many of us. Like you said, when you can mention a name like Joe, and we all know each other. Like, it's that small.
Right.
And that's a sign of a number of different things we can get into probably at a later date. But to the question at hand, which is, what does that mean for the GOP? What it means is it's Trump's party. It's a populist nationalist movement led by this individual who is going to take it wherever he wants to go and will have overwhelming compliance with that. Mm. So, I guess a lot of folks are going to be more engaged as Democrats, as Joe Walsh would be. The Democratic Party has asserted itself as the party that is going to defend the United States Constitution and classical liberalism. There's a lot more that us as conservatives, traditional conservatives, have in common with the Democratic Party than with a populist nationalist movement. I remain a registered Republican. Maybe I'll change, maybe I won't. I don't believe that I will be involved in partisan politics much anymore. I'll just be kind of doing more of the observing and pointing out what's happening to our body politic kind of the 30,000 foot level.
Yeah, one of the things that I think is cool as we talked to Mike Madrid is that you have always been someone who has had such a strong moral compass. Like, you have worked for Democrats and you helped them. Uh-huh. You've helped Republicans.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because at the center of everything that you do and it did and all of that has always been your love for the country and just you want to do the right thing, which that's pretty badass. I mean, that's awesome.
I suppose, but to me, it seems sort of commonsensical. Like, I really, really do love my country. Yeah. I love this country. What it's built, what it's been, what it claims to stand for, if not stand for, the fact that it fails in trying to be a better country consistently, but keeps getting up and doing the right thing. Like, that's the virtue of a people. Yeah. That is literally, it's not in accomplishing it. It's in fighting for it and struggling for it. That's the beauty of this country. That's the beauty of this human story. And to me, the parties, for most people, their partisan identification is as strong or stronger than religion.
Yep.
For me, it's never been that way. They have been tools to build a better America. And whichever one happens to be doing the right thing at the right time towards that end is a party or a candidate that I'm going to stand behind. And obviously, at this moment, that's not the Republican Party.
Right.
But this may sound very, very strange to a lot of people. I'm extremely optimistic about where we're heading as a country.
Yeah.
And you and I have had these conversations before.
Yep.
A good, virtuous, strong people and national character is built through struggle, only through struggle.
Yes.
And it's about the fight. The fight for what we believe in is what instills that character. And that's what we're going through right now.
Yeah, I think we're going to, as a country, have a pretty big snapback here. And I have one more question on this before we kind of get into, the meat of our discussion, the appointments, we've seen, does he take it seriously? Right. I mean, some of these, it's just like, he's appointing these people because he wants to own the libs. You know what I mean?
Yeah. But you also have to remember that loyalty has always been the number one test case for Donald Trump, right? Like, it's not. He has no political ideology, and I don't mean that in a pejorative sense. He literally does not. He's just transactional. To him, this is not, the Oval Office is not held in great esteem or reverence the way you or I do. To him, it's kind of like a business transaction.
Right.
Okay, well, now I'm president. What do we do? How do we get the most out of it? How do we get the most advantage? And what he realized very quickly, and I think especially through the January 6th stuff last time, was loyalty is what he demands. Yeah. It's not what your belief is. It's not who's going to do the best job. It's who's going to be the most loyal. And in 2016, it was a different scenario. He was learning the job. He tried to surround himself with people that had some core competency. He's not concerned about that at all now. They're not concerned about governing in the way that we traditionally view governance.
Right on. We got,
so as long as you're loyal, that's all that matters.
Yeah, we got Mike Madrid here on the Rational Revolution. We'll see you right back after the break.
You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Welcome back to the Rational Revolution. You got Mark Becker, my dear friend Mike Madrid. We're going to talk here. I read an article on Substack that Mikey wrote, and I really want people to read this. I'll post it, my stuff, the show will post it on their stuff, because it's really important to know kind of what has happened in our history. The article's titled Mass Deportations, A Dark History Returns, and the subject is, there have been two mass deportations of Mexicans and U.S. citizens of Mexican descent that have happened before in the United States. You don't know about it because this history isn't taught, and it's not. I read this, and it was a roller coaster of emotion. I was angry. I was motivated. It was heartbreaking. Talk about why did you write that article?
I wrote it because unless you're very in tune with sort of Latino and or Mexican American history, you don't know about this. And in fact, most Mexican Americans don't know about this because it is not taught. And this is not a small peripheral action. These two, and there have been two of them, mass deportations, they were huge. They were, we're talking well over a million people were forcibly removed. And again, when the population was even much smaller. So the fact that it's not taught, I think, is probably in part, you know, for a moment like this, which is we wake up and go, can that happen? Should that be happening? What's the law about that? We have asked these questions, exactly these questions, twice before, and there's a lot that we know about what happens and what can't happen when this type of a deportation event happens over the course of a few years with a military-style removal and operation.
What are the parallels that you see between any of, you know, either of the two ones in history, and is something from those two setting up what could happen here over the next couple of years?
That's a great question. So it's really important that people understand and breathe in the idea that the undocumented worker is here for a reason.
Yes.
And it's because the message goes out that there are jobs here, usually by very large enterprises. Historically, that's been in the agribusiness industry, where hundreds of thousands of workers, of labor units, people, human beings, are needed to come to pick crops so that they don't rot in the field. This has expanded as our economy has expanded, and this idea that somehow people are kind of coming in and taking jobs from Americans, white Americans is really what we're saying, is an absurd notion. We know that's not true. It's quantifiably not true, and this is not new, like I said. When things get bad, whether it's through public opinion or the economy and or both, you see a retrenchment, and this retrenchment began the first time in the Great Depression, as you pointed out in the introduction. And what happened when there was this dust bowlers in Oklahoma and Midwest, people were losing their homes, were being foreclosed on, and farms were being taken back by banks, there were meager but existent opportunities in the Great Central Valley of California. And so there was a mass migration west where people who were poor and destitute but knew how to work the land and knew how to harvest crops could find sustenance work. The problem was there were a lot of Mexicans and Mexican-American citizens doing that work. This created a conundrum, and the Hoover administration wanted to give those job opportunities to white Americans, and they did not want to spend New Deal government dollars on Mexican-American citizens. So the easy solution was, let's deport them. Let's literally go in and sweep them up. Over 1.8 million. Again, California was a quarter of the size that it is now. So this is a massive population shift. And literally scoop people up. Over a half of the people deported, quote unquote deported, were U.S. citizens.
Talk about that.
And they were, well, so what happens is, I mean, a lot of these were children because they were born here as the children of undocumented, of illegal aliens, undocumented immigrants, but not all of them. In fact, there were hundreds of thousands of adults who had been here some generationally that would do farm work as a living. But when you're doing something on the scale of a military operation to remove hundreds of thousands of people, you're not stopping to ask people in an orderly process to provide a documentation on who you are. And more often than not, you're not carrying your birth certificate with you to prove that you're an American citizen. So they would pick people up literally, put them in cages in the back of trucks, put them onto trains, and then they would process them when they got to Mexico. They would then ask, once you were in another country, where are you an American citizen? Where's your documentation? Of course, most of these people don't have any documentation because who carries their birth certificate with them when they're going out to do field work? Right. So a lot of these citizens were then sent very, very deep into Mexico because there were farming interests on the Mexican side of the border that wanted that labor too, and they didn't want them returning immediately back up to the Central Valley of California to compete with white Americans to deal with that labor shortage there. So when you're talking about what the Trump administration is currently talking about, which is they're claiming they want to deport 20 million people, which would have devastating economic impacts, let alone human impacts, but it would completely shut down the U.S. economy. But even if you did it in a scale back way, the way J.D. Vance suggested on the campaign trail, which is let's just do a million or so a year, you are now talking about a mass deportation event. This isn't like the deportation numbers under Biden or Trump or Obama or George Herbert Walker Bush. you know, whether, you know, deportations have gone up or down based off of immigration flows, this is legitimately a, quote, mass deportation event. And there's, it is impossible to not sweep up U.S. citizens and or break up families of U.S. citizen children in this process.
So how they did it back in the 30s was literally they went and they just put people into the back of the vans and brought them to Mexico and said, see ya.
Soldiers showed up to fields and manufacturing places, processing plants, armed soldiers. And they stopped work, loaded people onto trucks. Those trucks went to train stations. They loaded people up onto trains. And those trains then went down to Mexico to move them out of the country, at which point questions were then asked. Let's start processing and asking what's going on. So you can imagine, again, too, in the 1930s, there are huge family separation events at this time, too. A lot of younger children were not in the fields working. Some were, incidentally. Okay, child labor laws are very different. Yeah. But some of those children were at home, maybe with an extended family or with a mother or with an older sibling overlooking them, and their parents were just disappeared. They were gone for weeks until they could either find their way back or government services could kind of help them navigate their way going forward.
I think one of the things that stuck out from your article was when you kind of took a mental pause and talked about your mentor.
Yeah.
Tell that story.
There's a famous, iconic person. A lot of people know who Cesar Chavez was, who's the leader of the Farm Workers Union. But there's a man who I think holds a much greater place in Mexican-American history. His name was Cruz Reynoso. Cruz Reynoso was the first Mexican-American Supreme Court justice here in California. And he was a tireless advocate for the farm worker. He was one of eight children. Cruz's parents were farm workers. And he was an infant when his family was deported in this mass deportation. So his family was literally uprooted. He was an American citizen. His brothers and sisters were U.S. citizens. One of his parents was not. But that was enough to kind of just round people up and scoop them up and kind of move the entire family down. Upon his return, and a lot of people don't know much about this story either, but there were Mexican schools, which means that we had segregated schools throughout the South.
I got Mike Madrid. We're going to continue that story in just a moment here on the Rational Revolution. I want to pick that back up right after this here.
You're an organ donor, right? Well, here's a tragic fact. Approximately 20 people die each day waiting for precious donated organs. You could make a life-saving decision simply by getting that important dot on your driver's license. That little dot shows those who need to know that you've made a decision to donate organs at a critical time. Go to heroicdeed.com to learn more about the importance of organ donation and how you can make your wishes known. Talk to your family. Get the dot. Save lives. HeroicDeed.com.
Mark Becker here with the Rational Revolution. What's up, revolutionaries? We got dear friend Mike Madrid. Sorry I cut you off there, but you were talking on the other side about Mexican schools. And what happened there?
Yeah, so throughout the Southwest, early in the 1900s, we had school segregation, no different than you had with black and white segregation in the South. And again, this is a story that's not often told or made much aware of, but the actual court case in the federal jurisdiction that overturned segregation was not Brown versus Board at first. The first court case was a California case called Mendez versus Westminster, which eliminated Mexican schools, the segregation of schools. And actually, Thurgood Marshall filed an amicus brief, understanding that that case would be precedent for Brown versus Board.
Well, I had no idea. That's crazy.
Yeah. And so I think a lot of this history, unfortunately, because of the dark times that may be coming, will start coming to light. About the Mexican impacts of what happens during a dark period of history in our country.
Well, I want to talk about what's coming because, so, you know, the Trump famously in 2016 said he was going to build the wall, Mexico was going to pay for it, LOL, right?
Right.
But he also promised mass deportations. He failed on both accords. Is this different?
Well, I mean, look, it depends on what the definition of mass deportation is. Do I believe he will crack down on trying to get some of the most violent offenders out there? And they are there, incidentally. Yeah. No one is suggesting that everybody here is, you know, an angel. They're not. And there needs to be a process where that is remedied. I don't think anybody disagrees with that. Mm-hmm. The question is, does it go beyond that? And what now? Look, I would never bet that Donald Trump would do the right thing for humanitarian reasons. Uh-huh. But for economic reasons, with a lot of his wealthy friends, a lot of the industries in this country are reliant on this labor. That's why people are here. So whether it's agricultural farming and picking, or whether it's processing or meat packing in the Midwest, you go on and on and on. The hotel industry, the service sector is overwhelmingly reliant on undocumented labor. That's why there are 20 million workers here. So, are those interests going to just say, okay, well, we'll let these folks go and then quadruple our labor costs? Highly unlikely, highly, highly unlikely. But it's also, by the way, if you were to do that, extraordinarily inflationary.
Oh my God,
would explode. So there's a lot of economic reasons why he would not, but he's not going to do the right thing because it's the right thing.
Right. You know, it's interesting. So here in where this show is recorded in Green Bay, Wisconsin, we have a huge meat packing company. We have a couple of them. And I drive past on my way home every day past a massive dairy farm. And it's not white guys out there at 8 o'clock at night milking cows and shoveling manure. You know, it's not.
Yeah. Of course it's not.
And it's so funny because every time I've talked to someone about, oh, they're taking our jobs, it's like, you're not going to do that. Tell me you're going to do that.
Under any circumstance, no matter what the pay wage is, you will not do that job.
Right.
And that's what we have to recognize is, and that's a foundational part of the economy. The dairy industry is foundational to what we do. It's not like you're making, doorstops. This is necessary. And so once these economies become crippled, you're going to have a public reaction. And that's why I'm convinced that the economic interests that are reliant on this labor won't allow it to happen. Now, we'll see. I think there's going to be a lot of discussion and tension. But the reality is there's not a lot of white guys waiting in line to grab those jobs, shoveling manure in the middle of the night.
So he's going to do the right thing for the white guys and keep those people here, right? That's what his plan is.
That's kind of the history of the country. And that's why I wrote this Substack.
Right.
Because this is not new. This is a story as old as time. As old as the country.
He talked about using the military. Is that legal? Can he do that?
Well, like I said, it's been done before. And the way you get around it by saying legal is you declare these enemies of the state.
Oh.
And that opens up a whole different can of worms. It's kind of like what we did with the Japanese in turning the Japanese, right? Is you say that this is, a domestic terrorist plot, and we think that whatever rationale you can come up with begins that's how you get the ball rolling with engaging the military. And remember, in both of these mass deportations, the military was used,
right?
So there's precedent for it. Presidents have done this before, and if there's ever a president who would do it again, he's the one who's going to be sworn into office on January 20th.
I think, and one thing that, I talked to you about this before we were on the air, one of the things that I want people to do, and what I do with this show, is to try to educate and arm people with, how to see this for what it is. As we talked to Mike Madrid here, who's an expert on this stuff, how can people cut through the dog whistle stuff about, I don't know, stand back and stand by and all this other stuff. I talk to people and they say, well, he can't control who supports him. He can't. How can they see the racism for what it is?
Well, I think the first thing is to call it on the carpet, because you absolutely can control it. Yeah. Whatever you think of his policies, Ronald Reagan spoke out against the David Dukes in the party.
Yep.
Barry Goldwater's whole movement was predicated on driving white nationalists, white supremacists, and John Bercher's out of the party.
Yep.
So it is a complete fabrication to say you can't determine who supports them. You can delineate morally why these people should or should not be standing for you. So to me, that's kind of the most offensive moral capitulation, is to say, well, you can't help it if the racists support you. Yes, you absolutely can.
Yeah, you can.
Okay? And so the fact that he doesn't tells us everything that we need to do. But what I would also suggest is this. If you're in a debate or discussion with people and or him or whoever else about how this can or can't be done, you're already losing this fight and allowing this to be held on false pretenses, because you don't see people of moral standing with racists supporting them. You don't see people of good character with the Proud Boys behind them.
Yeah.
And so that you don't need to justify your natural instincts and righteous indignation. It's there for a reason. We all know that it's wrong. He knows that it's wrong, incidentally. And so that I think is becoming part of the character test of this nation at this moment in time. And it's what we have to struggle with to kind of demand that this be a better part of who we are.
Yeah, I said this last week on the episode that, you know, we talked a little bit about that. And I said, you know, if you walk into a room of Trump supporters and on the right you see, you know, white nationalists and the Proud Boys, and then on the other side you see, you know, anti-gay, Moms for Liberty, hate groups and all of that, you're standing in the wrong room.
Right. That's exactly it. It's like back in 2016, we would say, you know, I'd get asked all the time, are you calling all Trump supporters racist? And I'm not, you know, I'm not saying all Trump supporters are racist, but I'm saying all the racists are Trump supporters.
Right.
So I mean, if you walk into that room, we all have that you know, spider sense tingling that
yes,
this is not right. Trust that, because that's why that's there.
Right.
You know when something is not right. And that was actually the speech I gave at Cooper Union at the, you know, 150th anniversary of Reagan's speech. It was literally called this, you know, this is not right. That was the message. You know, we don't need to
right,
explain it. You know, it's not right. And Republicans do know it's not right.
Well, and they're, you know, not all Trump supporters are racists, but they certainly don't have an issue with being on the same team as them.
Yeah, exactly right. They're comfortable with it now.
Right. And so,
or always were,
yes,
by the way.
Right. Yeah. Right. You know, pass it off as, well, he can't control it. So how do you think this time would be different than 2016 with him actually being able to go through with some pretty dark stuff?
Well, I do believe two things. One, I believe that I think incompetence really saved us the last time.
Mm.
And I think that there's some elements to that this time. Remember, as I mentioned, I think in the early part of the discussion, in 2016, he surrounded himself with at least some establishment figures who had a basic concept and philosophy and understanding of government. This is not the case. Matt Gaetz, Tulsi Gabbard, RFK Jr., these are not serious people who are interested at all in advancing the cause of America. That is obviously problematic and horrifying. But at the same time, that leaves the opportunity for resistance, because remember, this interregnum period between the election and the swearing in is sort of a helpless moment. Joe Biden is
yes,
the president, and all we're doing is responding to stories. Once he becomes the president of the United States, you are going to see the resistance, the opposition, consolidate swiftly and strongly. I believe that's to my core. And now what you're going to see is less competent actors running the government responding to that political pressure. And you're going to have a lot of people in the business community saying, you know what? The instability of this government is not good for business. You're going
right,
to have to, because it's not, by
no,
the way.
Right.
This is everybody in the world's biggest market is the United States. Having us unstable is not good for business. He is going to be responsive to that. It's why people stepping up and voicing their concerns and being good, active, responsible, moral citizens is extremely important in the coming years.
So what can people do?
Well, I think a lot of it is we keep doing what we have been doing. And like I said, the difference between an election and civil, you know, protest is an election is about a hypothetical. It's about what you want it to be. Civil protest is about the factual, the actual, what is actually happening. Those are two very, very different considerations. And when things do begin to start happening, you are going to see people getting up and speaking out and not being afraid to speak out, which is the most important thing. is there's going to be a fear that if I say something, then, you know, I'll be on a list, or they're going to come out and get me. That's how authoritarianism wins. And the stronger you are, the louder the chorus gets. So we have to remember that. You've got to know there are strengths in numbers, and you've got to be one of those numbers being strong.
Yeah, I talk to people every week about, you know, having the courage to say what needs to be said regardless. I think that's really important.
If not, it does get worse.
Right, right. And final thoughts about, you know, how if this happens, and this, you know, what can good people do to, I didn't want to talk about this, but, like, you know, I have neighbors who he works in an assembly line at a plant. How can I help them?
Well, the first thing to do is ask, right? And be that voice, be that person. And I'm not trying to make an equivalency, but, you know, when somebody, when governments do start hunting people amongst them, it is only the neighbors, it is only the citizens around that can help. And whatever that may mean, it may mean, you know, finding a lawyer. May mean, you know, offering some advice. It may mean calling a congressman that you know. It may be, you know, it may mean more than that. But for the moment, I think the important thing is early in advance, is asking and letting people know, because there's extraordinary fear right now. There's terror in households right now in America. As much as so many of us are unsettled, there is sheer terror in many, many neighborhoods in this country. And letting them know that you are an ally and a supporter and somebody who can give them safe haven regardless of what they need, it would be incredibly comforting at this moment and would probably pay off with big dividends in the coming weeks and or months.
Yeah, and I never... What a surreal thing to be talking about.
Yeah, but this is our moment. It is surreal. This is something that we thought was behind us, but we have to remember that history rhymes. It never goes away. This will never be eliminated from the face of the earth as long as there are human beings. That's not the way this works. But what is required is each of us to do our part at this moment in time. And history has told us if we do, if we meet the moment, we will come out of this better and stronger. We will.
I believe that too, and I cannot thank you enough for your time here today. I can't thank you enough for your activism and for what you're doing and for your voice, bringing voice to millions of people. Seriously, it's amazing.
You're doing the same thing, and that's what it's all about. So I appreciate you. I appreciate your audience. I appreciate the engagement. Check out that article on Substack.
Yes.
It is a little bit jaw dropping. Educate yourself on what has happened in the past. Be armed with that. This is not hypothetical. There's evidence on how it was done and actually how to respond. So let's learn from those successes too.
Awesome. Mike Madrid, thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much for your time. Appreciate you, buddy.
Thank you. You bet.
All right. We'll be back right after this on the Rational Revolution.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Another word for nothing left to lose. Nothing. I mean, nothing, hon, if it ain't free.
You know, those music DJs, revolutionaries, they have some fun because you get to listen to music. You know, one of my friends is a DJ here. We're back on the Rational Revolution, by the way. You know, and they have to talk, and they got a morning show, and I always joke around about, you know, oh, geez, tough gig, man. You know, they get to listen to music and have fun, and so I was like, let that song go. But hey, it's time for my musings. This is fun too. This is pretty cool. We get to talk to some amazing people like Mike Madrid, who I really hope you guys take a moment to read that article. We will post it. It is eye-opening because, like he says in the article, it's not something that is talked about. I mean, really, when I read it, I was like, holy crap. Like, this was not, you know, we learned about Japanese internment camps, but what happened during those two mass deportation events was a larger activity of rounding up a certain, you know, socioeconomic or you know, ethnic group than what happened to the Japanese during the internment camp. So, like, it's wild, and it's not talked about. And this is what is on the table for potentially happening again. And I'll be damned if it happens here. We can't let that happen. And this is, you know, kind of what we talk about every week is that authoritarianism wins when people don't stand up. That's what he said. And that really stuck with me. Because what I'm going to talk to you about now is some of the to-don'ts of talking politics during Thanksgiving dinner. This is the last episode before Thanksgiving. And I want to talk to you about that. And so it's not the to-dos, it's the to-don'ts of what to don't do during Thanksgiving. And hopefully this helps. And the first one that I have is don't bring it up. All right, that's the first to don't. Don't bring it up. Don't be that guy. My friends, we are not that guy. However, if someone does bring it up, that brings me to number two, which is don't back down. Like Mike Madrid said, authoritarianism wins when people don't stand up. There is strength in numbers. And so when we take what we believe, and you are right, we are on the right side of history. Don't be afraid of that. That's not one of the to-don'ts, by the way. But because we're still on don't back down. Don't be afraid, because we are on the right side of history and there is strength in numbers. And some of these bad actors, when more people are on that side of history, there is a wave that will happen. So don't back down. We are divided and we don't get better and we don't heal by letting someone steamroll you, even when you're in the right. And that kind of brings me to number three, is don't forget that they're family. If you're at their house, you're at their house for a reason. And while knowing you are right and knowing that you're not going to back down, approach the conversations and come at those conversations from a place of love and concern for your family. I talk about her all the time. I have an aunt that believes that Donald Trump was sent by God and people are, you know, the elites are drinking children's bloods and all that kind of stuff. It's insane. I love my aunt and she's in a bad place. And I do engage with her when she engages with me, even how it's disgusting and pretty disrespectful to some people and not at all the person. That's the most heartbreaking thing, is she's not at all the person I knew growing up who taught me to be a good person and be kind to people and all that. That's gone. But I keep trying because, you know, I do understand that she is my family and I don't want to give up on her. That's really hard. And that brings me to number four is don't give up trying to change hearts and minds. And because, again, we are not going to give, or we're not going to win the battle for people's hearts and minds by giving up. And the last one that I have, number five, so the five to don'ts, is don't leave the night in a bad place. You know, many times this could be the only time you see these people all year during Thanksgiving. And don't forget that they're family and don't leave it in a bad place. You know, it's there's a way to navigate these conversations. And I've said this before, I'm not going to agree to disagree with you because you're wrong. I respect your right to have the wrong opinion, but it's wrong. And if we learned anything from a conversation with Mike Madrid today, good people don't do the things that Donald Trump has talked about doing. Good people don't support those things. Good people don't support rounding up 20 million people and kicking them out of the country and separating families. That's not who we are. And I want to say something. And I'm not saying this to, you know, boost my own ego or get goodwill or have a, you know, whatever. But I'm trying to make a point. I don't just say these things on the air. You know, I truly believe them and I live by them. And I hope you do too. Like a little bit about me, I have a small business. We own a car dealership and it's a very small one. We employ like 7 people. So, you know, but, and I did that. I became self-employed because I wanted to be able to have a legacy to give to my kids if they wanted to do something. I also wanted to, you know, be able to spend time with my kids and they can come to work and I can spend time with my wife at there and, you know, and just kind of take control over what my career is. I have everything to lose by speaking out. I do. I everything is at stake, but I do it anyway because I believe that if I don't, that's worse than losing a business, you know? And if I can do it, it breaks my heart when people say, oh, I don't want to get into it. It's like, no, we have to for the future of your children and this country and the world, as Mike Madrid said, we are, you know, this is the driver of the economy and the conscience of the world. And if we are in a place where we just don't want to get into it, well, we're going to not get out of this. And so, guys, if I can do it, so you can do it too. I am thankful for all of you. I am thankful for the opportunity to flap my gums on this microphone every week. For my family and friends, I hope you all have a wonderful Thanksgiving holiday and take those to don'ts and enjoy your turkey and stuffing or whatever. Go Packers. And we will talk to you next week on The Rational Revolution. I'm Mark Becker. Thanks for joining us.
Go and fall away, fall away. Oh, may the last one burn into flames. Freedom, freedom, I can't move.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.